Now for some comedy, and afterward, something that at least in its way is light at heart. We start with something of a reprise from two guys named Bob and Ray, who created all kinds of characters during their long tenure on radio. This takes us to a stage performance of May 31st, 1984, and we'll tap into the sports room.
Good evening, fans. This is Biff Burns in the sports room. And we have a particularly appropriate guest with me now, with the Olympics only a few weeks away. He's Big Steve Werbler, and he's the world champion high jumper. And you're going to be hearing a lot from Big Steve. Welcome to the sports room.
Well, it's good to be here. I'd like to make one correction, though, Biff.
Sure.
You said I was the world champion high jumper. Actually, I'm the world champion low jumper.
Well, can't be very much difference between the two events. What's your best mark in the low jump?
I jumped 57 feet 8 inches, which is about 50 feet farther than the record high jump.
Sounds as if there might be more difference between the two events than... Of course, you and I know what that difference is, but for the benefit of the fans looking in, would you care to explain it?
Sure. Well, in high jumping, you stand in a low place and see how high up you can jump. And in low jumping, you stand in a high place and see how far down you can jump.
Well, Big Steve, you and I both know the answer to this next question, but for the benefit of the fans looking in, would you care to comment if that's all there is to it?
No. If you jump from a high place and get killed, then that jump does not count. And that's why my 57-foot-8-inch record still stands.
This may be an embarrassing question for you, but I've got to put it anyway. Isn't this kind of a dumb sport that would only appeal to a big lummox like yourself, who has rocks in his head?
Well, I guess you could make a pretty good argument for that, Biff. But I like low jumping a lot better than high jumping. See, in high jumping, you can strain a tendon, pull a muscle on the way up, and break a bone, maybe on the way down. But in low jumping, all you have to worry about is what happens to you on the way down.
Well, I can see the logic there, although it may be a little too complicated for some of the fans looking in. At any rate, I understand that you're trying to get the Olympic Committee to consider this as a major track and field event, the low jump.
Well, see, it's a little too late for this year's Olympics.
Right.
But I haven't been able to interest the Olympic Committee at all in the event, so I don't know. There's a producer here in New York who wants to have us jump off the Palisades over in New Jersey into the Hudson River. But that would not be an official jump because you can't land in anything soft like water or anything.
Oh.
No.
I thought the object of the whole thing was just to live through it.
Yeah.
I didn't know the surface here you landed on made any difference.
I jump mostly onto asphalt and concrete. But you can land on natural ground, providing it hasn't been softened with rain or moisture or anything.
Right. How about AstroTurf, stuff like that?
Well, AstroTurf's okay, providing the phony grass isn't too tall so as to break your fall, or then again been softened by moisture.
So if you did get this thing accepted as a real official event, I guess you'd have to do it from the window of the downtown office building, something
well,
like that?
Well, yeah, so that's not too satisfactory, because in case of a tie then, you have to go up a whole story, which is, what, like 10 feet. Now, a much better arrangement would be to use a fire department truck, and in case of a tie, you go up a rung at a time, see?
That makes sense. Now, I know you've done a lot of research on this, Big Steve, and sent out a lot of mailing and so forth. How many entrants do you think there would be from around the world if this got to be accepted?
Well, from the mail I've received, there are two other entrants. One is a Tibetan who puts himself in a trance and jumps off mountains. And the other guy is kind of flaky. He's from France.
All right, well, there would be two, and then yourself would make three, so there would be three.
There'll be just two. I've decided not to jump anymore. I figure it'd take a real, real fruitcake to think he could break a 57-foot, 8-inch record that I already hold, you know. And I've learned through experience that low jumping 30 or 40 feet can give you a real headache. So I say, who needs it?
Well, I was going to say that at the outset of the interview, but you've said it for me, and I want to thank you for dropping by the sports room here tonight.
It's always great to talk to you, Biff.
Sure. Big Steve Werbler. And this is Biff Burns saying until next time. This is Biff Burns saying so long, fans.
Bob and Ray from the sports room, and actually it was Carnegie Hall on the evening of May 31st, 1984. Well, you might have heard last night our broadcast from 1945 of Lux Radio Theater with the Canterville Ghost. And if you did, you can compare. And if you didn't, you're in for a treat as we hear another version of that same Oscar Wilde classic right after this on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Sign up for Wisconsin Public Radio's monthly e-newsletter to find out about all things WPR. You'll get in-depth information on programs, news, and upcoming events. Go to WPR.org to sign up today.
He was a trendsetter of a kind. He was certainly an original. He was a character, sometimes a caricature. He was a lecturer. And he was also a writer, although Oscar Wilde was not taken seriously as such in 1887 when he wrote his story, The Canterville Ghost, which is about confrontations, cultural and otherwise, but particularly between 16th century sensibilities and those of England and 19th century American sensitivities and sensibilities. That's what he was up to in The Canterville Ghost in 1887, some 4 years before he became really well known for the picture of Dorian Gray and Lady Windermere's Fan later on and The Importance of Being Earnest. Well, from 1969, December 18th of the year, we have this WHA Players production produced by Ralph Johnson, featuring Ken Ost and Carol Cowan and Jay Fitz and Cliff Roberts. It's Oscar Wilde and The Canterville Ghost.
The Canterville Ghost, a play for radio based on the short story by Oscar Wilde. Produced in stereophonic sound by WHA, the University of Wisconsin. The time is early evening, the place somewhere in 19th century England. Now, the Canterville Ghost.
For the last time. I hear they'll be at the inn tonight, and then on to Canterville Chase in the morning.
Oh, they'll be back soon enough, running and yelling and screaming for help.
I heard Lord Canterville himself warn them. Did his duty right and proper, he did. Told them about it. They were all fine and grand and climbed as what it wasn't anything Americans couldn't handle. You know Jane, who works in Lord Canterville's kitchen?
Yeah.
Well, anyway, she told me that John, you know, the butler.
Yeah.
Well, he told her that Lord Canterville had acted like he didn't even want to sell the place.
Oh.
Yes, when that new American minister came to inquire, his lordship told him how it's been haunting for ever so long. Told him about the old Duchess dying there, a fright it was.
And now he's taking the missus and the children there to live. Why, that poor lady's hair will go all white when she sees it. Or do they lose it altogether?
You know what Jane said, he said?
Who said?
The one that bought it. You know, the new American minister. But anyway, he told Lord Canterbury...
Oh, I know, I know. He don't believe in ghosts.
There was something else. He said... Oh... How did Jane put it? Yes. He said, the laws of nature, he says, are not going to be suspended for the British Empire.
Wretched weather this country has. Yeah, who's that waiting for us by the door?
Oh, that must be the housekeeper that Lady Canterville mentioned.
I'm Mrs. Omney. I bid you welcome to Canterville Chase.
Thank you. Shall we go in?
I'm soaked to the bone.
I shall take your coat, sir. There's tea laid out in the library. This way, please.
What a nice room. I can see that there will be very little I'll have to change.
Shall I serve the tea, madam?
Yes. Mr. Otis takes one sugar and lemon. I take two sugars, plain. Virginia likes warm milk and no sugar. And Washington...
I'd really like coffee and some of those little cakes, Mrs. Umney.
Oh, I hadn't prepared any coffee.
Never mind. Tea will be fine.
Oh.
Mrs. Umney?
Yes, madam.
Of course, I don't blame you... But there seems to be a stain on the carpet over there by my son's chair.
Oh, madam. Blood has been spilt on that spot.
Well, how horrid. I don't care at all for blood stains in the sitting room. It must be removed at once.
It is the blood of the Lady Eleanor de Canterville, madam. She was murdered on that very spot by her own husband, Sir Simon de Canterville. In 1575, Sir Simon survived 9 years and disappeared suddenly under very mysterious circumstances. His body has never been discovered, but his guilty spirit still haunts Canterville Chase. The bloodstain has been much admired by tourists and others and cannot be removed.
That's ridiculous. Here, Pinkerton's Champion Stain Remover and Paragon Detergent will clean it up in no time.
Oh, no.
Mrs. Umney, do you have a rag? Never mind. My handkerchief will do just as well. There, I knew Pinkerton's would do it.
But it's gone.
What's that?
Thunder, you nit.
Well, Mrs. Umney seems to have fainted.
My dear Hiram, what can we do with a woman who faints?
Charge it to her, like breakages. She won't faint after that.
Thank you.
Could I have another cup of coffee, dear? I don't want to go to sleep until I finish this article for the Times on the advantages of the baggage check system in railway traveling.
There you are. Did I tell you that I saw Lady Rand today?
Not the Lady Rand.
Yes, we had the most scintillating conversation about the importance of Boston in the development of the world's soul.
Well, was Lady Rand convinced?
I'm not sure. She kept interrupting my trend of thought with vague references to our ghost. By the way, Hiram, the bloodstain's still there.
Yes, I noticed. Perhaps the Paragon detergent isn't as potent as we thought. Washington, have you been applying it regularly?
Yes, sir. Virginia was with me at the time of the last application.
Virginia, have you anything to say?
Well, no, Father. It's as Washington says. The first night, he removed the spot. We came down in the morning, and it was there again. Well, he removed it the second night. It reappeared the second morning, whereupon the butler was brought in and accused. Well, you then decided to lock the door last night to prevent anyone from entering the library to refurbish the bloodstain. And this morning, there it was again.
And I might add that Mrs. Umney has been keeping me awake at night, praying to Sir Simon. That is supposed to be the old ghost's name, isn't it? Anyway, she begs him to forgive us, and I quote, "They know not wherewith they trespass." Really, it's just too annoying.
Well, I think she's sweet.
I think perhaps I was a bit dogmatic in my denial of the existence of ghosts.
I have an idea. Why don't we all join the Ascot Psychical Society? I've heard they have the most lovely teas.
It could be the ghost. I don't think it can be the fault of Paragon detergent. Nevertheless, I'm going to write a letter to the manufacturers.
To Messrs. Meyer and Podmore, New York. Dear Sirs, regarding the subject of the permanence of sanguineous stains when connected with crime, I wish to inquire as to the reason your Paragon detergent is inefficacious. I further wish to inquire as to the possible existence of any precedent whereby such a failure of your detergent has heralded the occasion of what is known to the uneducated as a ghostly apparition.
Yes, the terrible old man. Let's see. Eyes, red burning coals. Perfect, perfect. Long gray hair. Long gray hair falling over my shoulders in matted coils. Clothes. Oh, what should I wear? Nothing looks bad enough. Oh, no matter. This will do. Just so long as it's soiled and tattered. And, of course, heavy manacles and rusty shackles hanging from my wrists and ankles. There. That should do it. Oh, I'll be late. Oh, I wish I weren't in such a good mood. I'll never manage the moaning. Well, I do without. I'll start with Mr. Otis. It's so exhilarating to watch horror in a middle-aged man. I really must moan. What is a haunting without a moan? Ooh. Oh, sure. Come on now, Canterville.
Ooh. Oh, really? Well, what time is it? Where are the matches? Here they are. Almost 1 o'clock. Some people have no decency. Where is that bottle? Good, here it is. Now, my slippers.
I can practically hear his screams, see the agony in his eyes, feel his heart stop. Any second, the horrible confrontation. Now!
My dear sir, I must really insist on your oiling those chains.
Yeah.
For that purpose, I brought you a small bottle of the Tammany Rising Sun Lubricator.
Tammany Rising Sun?
It is said to be completely efficacious upon one application, and there are several testimonials to that effect on the wrapper from some of our most eminent American authorities.
But I
shall leave it for you by the bedroom candles, and will be happy to supply you with more, should you require it. Good night.
Tammany Rising Sun Lubricator? Testimonials from some of our most eminent American authorities? Indeed. He undoubtedly would have been frightened out of his wits, were he not so busy being mundane. Tammany Rising Sun Lubricator? Is that a civil thing to say to any ghost, much less the Canterville ghost? Oh, he shall pay for this. He shall pay dearly. Obviously a man of no education. Tammany Rising Sun. Never in 300 billion years so insulted, so thwarted. A chain of uninterrupted success is broken. I, who frightened the Dowager Duchess into a fit as she stood before the mirror in her lace and diamonds. I, who terrorized the four housemaids by merely grinning at them through the curtains of one of the spare bedrooms. I, who reduced the rector of the parish to a perfect martyrdom of nervous disorders. Is it really so many decades since the wicked Lord Canterville was found choking in his dressing room with the Ace of Diamonds halfway down his throat and confessed just before he died that he had cheated Charles James Fox out of £50,000 by means of that very card and swore that I, the Canterville ghost, had made him swallow it? How long since the butler shot himself in the pantry because he had seen my green hand tapping at the window pane? How long since the beautiful Lady Stutfield was obliged to wear a black velvet band round her throat to hide the mark of my five fingers burned upon her white skin? How long since she drowned herself at last in the carp pond at the end of King's Walk? It seems but a few years since the lovely Barbara Meldish broke off her engagement with the present Lord Canterville's grandfather and ran off to Gretna Green with the handsome Jack Castleton, all on my account. They have not yet forgotten my last appearance as Red Reuben, the strangled babe. And what of my debut as Gaunt Gideon, the bloodsucker of Bexley Moor? Yes, there are many who shiver yet to remember that lonely June evening when I played ninepins with my own bones upon the lawn tennis ground. And after all this, some wretched American offers me Tammany Rising Sun Lubricator? It'll not be tolerated. Besides, there is no historical precedent for such treatment of a ghost. I will have my vengeance.
May I have some more tea, Mrs. Umney? Now, before I forget, there's a small matter I would like to discuss with the entire family. I feel that you're all aware of the events of last night, Virginia?
Oh, yes, Papa. Washington has told me.
While we're on the subject, Father, I wish to call it to your attention that the bloodstain refurbishing continues. And it seems that the old boy has an artistic temperament. The stain is a rather bright orange this morning.
It's probably some petulant little protest over last night. Orange?
Yes, quite a bright orange.
Sunburst orange, number 26.
Thank you.
Pass the toast, Washington.
Well, I don't know about anyone else, but as for me, I'm certain that except for the bloodstains, we'll not hear from the ghost again.
But the bloodstain's still there.
Yes, my dear sister, but it's obvious that he's at the end of his tether. This morning, it's a bright green.
Emerald green number 8.
And who has ever heard of green blood? It's ridiculous. I'm sure he'll disappear altogether soon.
Oh, I hope so. Green's such a vulgar color.
An entire week I have lain with aches and bitter memories. But tonight, I go forth and put an end to all of them. The vulgarity of that boy, the gross materialism of that woman. Where is my rumpled beret? Here's my rusty dagger. It's a possibility. But I'd rather have my rumpled beret. No matter. What goes with a rusty dagger? Blue patched shawl. No. Leopard skin loincloth. Loincloth? Marvelous. Here's my red feather. I've got to fit that in. Oh, yes. Here's my large brown slouched hat. Now that, with my red feather, my rusty dagger, and my most bedraggled shroud. That's good. Yes. Yeah. It's missing something. My most bedraggled shroud, frilled at both the wrists and the neck. Lovely. Terrible. And best of all, picturesque. This may be the greatest of all my appearances. It's pouring out. And it's getting darker. More dingy. Still more dearthful. Rain and thunder. Oh, yes. Dare I hope for lightning? Now the plan. I must plot a careful course. The other encounters with this abusive family were ill-contrived meetings conceived in moments of passion. I must be calm, cool, sober, temperate. At 12 o'clock, I shall steal my way, quietly, to the room of that boy, the presumptuous cur that dares to remove the Canterville bloodstain with Pinkerton's Paragon detergent, indeed. For him, there'll be something special. I'll begin with customary beginning. After sitting upon his chest so as to produce the stifling sensation of nightmare, I will sit next to him in his bed in the form of a green, icy cold corpse until he becomes paralyzed with fear. Finally, I will throw off my winding sheet and crawl round the room with white bleached bones and one rolling eyeball. In short, in the character of Dom Daniel, the suicide's skeleton. No, that's too good for him. I'll keep the part in about stealing quietly to his room, only I'll gibber at him from the foot of the bed, yeah. And then stab him 3 times in the throat to the sound of slow music. Having reduced him to a condition of abject terror, I'll proceed to the room of Mr. Otis and his wife. There, I shall place a clammy hand on Mrs. Otis's forehead while I hiss into her trembling husband's ear the awful secrets of the charnel house. Well, that will leave me little Virginia. What should I do with her? She's never really insulted me in any way. She's rather pretty and gentle. I think a few hollow groans from her wardrobe closet suffice. And if that fails to wake her, I could scratch a bit at her window panes with palsied, twitching fingers. Oh, that will do it.
Come on, Virginia. Just look at it.
No, I don't even want to know about it. Leave him alone. You've done enough already.
But I can't resist. It's just too tempting.
Ah, now. It is time. Yes. The owl beats against the window pane. And the raven croaks from the old yew tree. And the storm rages on. And the American minister sleeps unaware of what awaits. On and on I glide, like an evil shadow, the very darkness seeming to loathe me as I pass. What's that? Oh. Ah. It's the baying of the old gray dog at yonder red farm. And now my curse. Sticky, sticky Stombo, no so Rombo, holy, holy Bosco, Iconon, Nuanon, Conoron, Tombo. The door of the luckless Washington Otis. First victim of my...
Washington! What did you do to him?
I've planted a small impediment in his
path. It's more monstrous than a madman's dream.
Carefully calculated to scare...
That horrible... bald, burnished head.
I've made its face to appear round and fat and
that
white.
That grin. That dreadful grin.
It appears that piercing rays of scarlet light stream from its eyes. That effect cost me a candle and two turnips.
Its mouth is a wide well of fire.
I had quite a time with the clothing.
That hideous garment.
It probably appears much like his own.
Why do I tremble before it? What is the meaning?
I figured he'd probably never really seen another ghost and would naturally be terribly frightened. So I left a little something else. The, pièce de résistance, you might call it.
I wonder, what's that strange placard on its breast? It seems to have some weird writing on it. Oh, probably some scroll of shame. Some record of wild sins. Some awful calendar of crimes. Some, oh... I've got to get out of here. Oh, now. Some decorum, Canterville. It may be a sympathetic spirit, a fellow. And surely, two ghosts are better than one. I shall go and speak to him. Pat him on the back, as it were. My dear sir. Eh? Its head fell off. And his arm is a white dimity bed curtain with a sweeping brush and a kitchen cleaver inside. The note probably explains. Ye Otis ghost, ye only true and original spook, beware of your imitations. All others are counterfeit. Misspelled at that. Beware of imitations. All others are counterfeit. Counterfeit. Oh, tricked, foiled, outwitted, overcome, outdone, fooled, flummoxed. Oh, I swear. As I raise this withered hand high above this gray head and grind my toothless gums together, I swear that
When Chanticleer has sounded twice his merry horn, deeds of blood will be wrought, and murder will walk abroad with silent feet. Ah, yes, the first crow of the cock. Yes, and certainly the cock will crow soon. His second terrible crow. His second crow. When Chanticleer has sounded twice his many horn, etc., etc. Yes. It cannot be. According to every book on ancient chivalry, on every occasion when that oath has been used, Chanticleer has always crowed a second time. Oh, that rotten bird! Chanticleer always crows twice. Perdition seize that naughty fowl. I have seen the day when, with my stout spear, I would have run him through the gorge and made him crow for me and 'twere in death. Oh, here I lie in my room, ill, weak, and tired. So tired. I can't believe it's only 4 weeks since they moved in. My nerves are completely shattered. 4 weeks, and I've lost all control. And they sit merrily at the breakfast table, stuffing themselves on my defeats.
Another piece of toast, Hiram?
Yes, please. I feel rather good this morning. Yes, another piece of toast.
I wish to announce a triumph. It is 5 days since last he appeared. There are no further bloodstains on the carpet. It is a fitting time to announce my triumph over the ghost.
Although I deeply regret my temporary incapacity to haunt, I have nothing to be ashamed of in the matter of the bloodstain. Why make a point of something which the present occupants of the house neither appreciate nor frankly deserve? The Otises are evidently people on a low plane of existence, quite incapable of appreciating the symbolic value of sensuous phenomena.
Virginia, you're so quiet. Is something the matter?
No, it's just that I don't think it was necessary for Washington to persecute the ghost.
All I did was to put a little water...
I've undoubtedly contracted pneumonia from that unthinking boy. The question of phantasmic apparitions and the development of astral bodies aside... Doesn't he realize that it's my solemn duty to appear in the corridor once a week and to gibber from the large oriel window on the first and third Wednesday of every month? I've compromised at every turn. When I trod the old worm-eaten boards, I trod lightly. I've even, humiliating as it seems, I've even taken to oiling my chains with rising sun lubricator, surreptitiously stolen from the room with the American ambassador. I've fastidiously avoided my more dramatic garb. But all this wasn't enough for him. Oh, no.
There he was in this ridiculous outfit, some old dirty sheet.
There I was, simply but neatly clad in a long shroud, tastefully spotted with churchyard mold. I had tied my jaw with a little strip of yellow linen. A small lantern and a sexton's spade completed my furnishings. I was, in short, dressed as Jonas the Graveless, the corpse snatcher of Chertsey Barn. It was about 2:15 in the morning, and I was quite naturally interested to know if any traces of the bloodstain remained.
There he was, skulking around the library, up to no good. And as he turned the corner...
I turned the corner when this awful sound burst upon my ears.
I shouted, "Boo!" And did he ever run in every which direction?
Momentarily disconcerted, I quickly regained my composure. I realized the poor joke that been perpetrated by that knavish boy. I waited an hour, hoping to put him off his guard. And then I glided down the corridor to his room.
I went back to my room, knowing he'd return. I made my preparations and carefully left my door
open. To my luck, the door was slightly ajar.
The whole thing was ready when he came in.
Wishing to make an effective entrance,
I flung open the door.
As the door swung open, a jug of water
out
fell
of
on him.
Nowhere came a burst of water, wetting me to the skin, leaving me ill for days. I'll probably never regain enough strength to haunt properly again.
And he hasn't shown up in 4 days. That makes 5 mornings since the last appearance of the bloodstain and 4 since the ghost. And furthermore, I expect that word of my victory has reached the village, and they will be standing along the road waiting for me to pass so that they might cheer me.
Mother, may I be excused? I want to go riding this morning. La la, la la la. Why, what's that? I never knew there was a room next to the tapestry chamber. Who's there? Oh!
It's only the Canterville ghost, sitting alone at the window, watching the ruined gold of the yellow trees fly through the air, and the red leaves dance madly down the long avenue. The long... Log Avenue.
Oh, I am sorry for you. Well, perhaps it will comfort you to know that my brother Washington leaves for Eton tomorrow. If you behave yourself, no one will annoy you.
It's absurd asking me to behave myself. Quite absurd. I must rattle my chains and groan through keyholes and walk about at night, if that's what you mean. It's my only reason for existing.
Well, it's no reason at all for existing, and you know you have been very wicked. Why, Mrs. Umney told us the first day we arrived here that you had killed your wife.
Well, I quite admit it. But it was a purely family matter. It concerned no one else.
It is very wrong to kill anyone.
Oh, I hate the cheap severity of abstract ethics. My wife was very plain. Never had my ruffs properly starched. Knew nothing about cookery. Why, there was a buck I had shot in Hegley Woods. Magnificent cricket. And you know how she had it sent up to the table? However, it's no matter now, but it's all over. And I don't think it was very nice of her brothers to starve me to death, though I did kill her.
Starve you to death? Oh, Mr. Ghost, Sir Simon, are you hungry? Well, I'll bring you a sandwich.
No, thank you. I never eat anything now, but it's very kind of you all the same. And you really are much nicer than the rest of your horrid, rude, vulgar, dishonest family.
Stop! It is you who are rude and horrid and vulgar, and as for dishonesty, you know you stole the paints out of my paint box to try and furbish up that ridiculous bloodstain in the library. Why, first you took all my reds, including my vermilion. I couldn't do any more sunsets. Then you took the emerald green and the chrome yellow, and I finally had nothing left but indigo and Chinese white, and could only paint moonlight scenes, which are always depressing to look at and not at all easy to paint. Well, I never told on you, though I was very much annoyed, and it was most ridiculous, why, the whole thing. For who ever heard of emerald green blood?
Well, really, what was I to do? It's a very difficult thing to get real blood nowadays. And as your brother began it all with his Paragon detergent, I certainly saw no reason why I should not have your paints. As for color, that's always a matter of taste. Now, the Cantervilles have blue blood, for instance, the very bluest in England. But I know that you Americans don't care for this sort of thing.
Well, you know nothing about it. And the best thing you can do is to emigrate to America and improve your mind. Why, once in New York, you're sure to be a great success. Oh, I know lots of people there who would give $100,000 to have a grandfather and, well, much more than that to have a family ghost.
I don't think I should like America.
Oh, I suppose because we have no ruins and curiosities like you have in England.
No ruins and curiosities? You have your political parties and your manners.
Goodbye. I'm going to ask Papa to get Washington an extra week of vacation.
Oh, please don't go, Miss Virginia. I am so lonely and so unhappy. I really don't know what to do. I want to go to sleep, but I cannot.
Well, that's quite absurd. Well, you've merely to go to bed and blow out the candle. Well, it's very difficult sometimes to keep awake, especially at church. But there is no difficulty at all about sleeping. Why, even babies know how to do that, and they are not very clever.
I've not slept for 300 years.
For 300 years I've not slept, and I'm so tired.
Oh, poor, poor ghost. Have you no place where you can sleep?
Far away beyond the pine woods, there's a little garden. There the grass grows long and deep. There are the great white stars of the hemlock flower. There the nightingale sings all night long. All night long he sings, and the cold crystal moon looks down. And the yew tree spreads out its giant arms over the sleepers.
You mean the Garden of Death?
Yes, death. Death must be so beautiful, to lie in the soft brown earth with the grasses waving above one's head and listen to the silence, to have no yesterday and no tomorrow, to forget time, to forgive life, to be at peace. You can help me. You can open for me the portal of death's house, for love is always with you, and love is stronger than death is. Have you ever read the old prophecy on the library window?
Oh, often. Yes, I know it quite well. It is painted in curious black letters, and it's difficult to read. There are only 6 lines. When a golden girl can win prayer from out the lips of sin, when the barren almond bears and a little child gives away its tears, then shall all the house be still, and peace come to Canterville. But I don't know what they mean.
They mean that you must weep for me, for my sins, because I have no tears, and pray with me for my soul, because I have no faith. And then, if you've always been sweet and good and gentle, the angel of death will have mercy on me. You will see fearful shapes in darkness, and wicked voices will whisper in your ear. But they will not harm you, for against the purity of a child, the powers of hell cannot prevail.
I'm not afraid, and I will ask the angel to have mercy on you.
Then we must go quickly.
Where's Virginia? Oh, Hiram, I know something dreadful has happened.
Mother, she's nowhere in the garden, and I had some of the men of the village help me drag the carp pond.
And?
She's not in the carp pond.
You know, a few days ago, I gave a band of gypsies permission to camp in the park. Do you suppose...
Oh, they've carried her off. I just know the gypsies have carried her off.
You must go to bed, dear. There's nothing more we can do tonight.
I can't sleep knowing my little Virginia has been carried off by the gypsies. Maybe they're selling her this very minute.
Nothing can be done tonight. I'll telegraph London Yard in the morning.
Virginia!
Virginia! Oh, my dear, my
good heavens,
dear.
Child, where have you been? We've been riding all over the country looking for you, and your mother's been frightened to death. You must never play these practical jokes again.
Except on the ghost, of course.
Oh, my darling, thank God you are found. You must never leave my side again.
Mama, Papa, I have been with the ghost. He has been very wicked, but he was really sorry for all that he has done.
Look at that. Look out the window. The old withered almond tree has blossomed. I can see the flowers quite plainly in the moonlight.
When the barren almond bears, and a little child gives away its tears, then God has forgiven him.
Here comes the funeral procession from Canterville.
I knew it had happened. I said they'd be leaving the place. Although I didn't expect the ghost to wipe out the whole family.
Oh, didn't you hear?
Yeah.
It's the ghost what's dead.
What?
Oh, yes, the girl, the Otis girl, saved his soul or something, and now they're burying the old bones.
Well, I'll be.
Yes, and after the ghost's properly buried, the queen herself is going to give the girl a medal.
A medal?
Oh, yes, she's going to be presented at the court and be given a medal or a ribbon or both. all for saving the soul of a noble old ghost. Oh, it's going to be a big thing. Well, yeah, it's what you might call an international increment or something. There's an American girl saved a British ghost.
That's all poppycock. You know that? I mean, who believes in ghosts except American tourists? She's gonna get a ribbon for getting rid of something that never really was.
Oh, my. You ought to have a little respect.
The Canterville Ghost, a stereophonic radio production by WHA, the University of Wisconsin. The script by Beth Elpern was based on the short story by Oscar Wilde. Engineering by Marv Nunn, musical effects by Don Vagley and Jay Fitz. Production by Ralph Johnson. The cast included two Cockney voices,
Jay Fitz, who also played the housekeeper, Mrs. Umley,
and Carol Cowan, who also appeared as Mrs. Otis.
Mr. Otis was played by
Cliff Roberts.
Virginia and Washington Otis,
Helen Tootin.
And Bob Engle.
And the ghost? Oh, that's right, isn't it? Poor thing's dead.
It was really me, Ken Oust.
And this is Ken Oust speaking for the National Educational Radio Network.
And there you have The Canterville Ghost, the Oscar Wilde classic, as produced by the WHA Players, December 18, 1969, featuring Ken Oust and Carol Cowan, Jay Fitz, and Cliff Roberts, as produced by Ralph Johnson here at Wisconsin Public Radio. That's it for Old Time Radio Drama for this Sunday night. I'm Norman Gilliland. We'll have more next Sunday from 8 to 11. I hope you can be with me by the glow of your radio. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.